Hey there, this is Seth Juarez from Channel 9, coming to you from NDC Oslo in Norway. How are you, my friend?
I'm grand, how are you?
Fantastic. Why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm Gemma Cameron, Ruby Gem, on the Twitter. I am a principal software engineer at Co-op Digital. I also do a load of tech community stuff around the northwest in England.
Fantastic. So how did you get into programming?
It's a very long story.
Me too.
And I was really young, and I remember my dad coming back from work. I'm really sorry, by the way. I speak English, but it's with a really Mancunian accent.
I love it. It makes it sound smarter.
That's one word for it. when I was little, my dad brought a laptop back from work, and I just started playing on it. I must have been about 5, 6, something like that. Might be making that up. But I just started playing around, making, like, I think I made birthday card invites.
Nice.
For my friends coming around, like the old sort of, you know, the dot, the dot matrix printer and the old sort of BBC thing. Started messing around the command line, playing games, all that kind of stuff. And then I was about 12, the internet came out, got a modem. This is a long, long time ago.
I remember those days.
Yeah.
We had the internet that had the coax cables. And
have coax tables. We didn't have that.
It was before then.
Yeah, it was all telephone line with that.
Yes, and then I networked my computers together, and they had this. It was 10 base T, and I hooked these things in, and it would never work. And I realized that you had to plug the other end in because the internet would spill out. Apparently.
Yeah. Buckets of internet.
That's right. Which is everywhere. It got it all over the floor. And so the internet was really cool for me growing up, because that's where I was like, I really want to learn how to do this stuff. So was it the same for you?
Yeah, so it just opened up a whole new world of things. I could find stuff out, start playing with HTML, doing some web pages and stuff like that. So what we were talking about in the keynote, about having that book that was like the encyclopedia of the internet, I remember getting a magazine to find out web pages and stuff to go to. a 33.6 modem and all this. It was amazing. It was great that opened things up. Whereas before I'd been getting animation software and stuff and playing around with that, and just messing around the command line. So all of a sudden I could start doing stuff that was a bit more visual and making cool stuff. Then, playing with that, then I went to work placements and work experience and stuff like that in England at school. And that was when I was about 14 or something, and I went to work at an Apple repair shop up the road.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and because I was interested in playing on computers. The thing that was really interesting, I went to Lancaster University on a school trip, and we went to see the coldest place in the world. So they'd managed in their physics department to get the closest to absolute zero. So
that's zero Kelvin.
Yeah, so that's why we'd gone along. So we're like, oh, this is cool. But then we went and started showing you all the careers and stuff you could have, and all the courses they do at the university. One of them I saw, I was like, computer science. That's what I'm doing.
Oh, my
goodness.
And
I was really lucky that when I was 14, that's what I decided I wanted to do.
So that was, 5 years ago?
Oh, thank you.
Yeah,
a long, 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 long time ago. And, I was really lucky because I got to play all my GCSEs, all my A-levels, all geared towards getting this degree.
And you've been computer sciencing from the beginning of time when the internet started.
Yeah.
That's the beginning of time for computers.
Yeah, I've obviously got really good eye cream.
Nice. And so what kind of programming did you get into first? I'm trying to see trajectory because there's a lot of people watching who are like, hey, I want to be a programmer too. There's kind of a lot of things you can do as a programmer. What did you decide to do?
I don't really know. So playing around with HTML was really good.
Yeah.
Because I got to sort of mess around with that. And then going on to the next bit, which was putting dynamic content onto the sites and realising how that worked. But again, a lot of it back in the day was just messing around the command line. Mm. So loading up programs, digging around, trying to fix things, put stuff together. But when I went to uni, that's when I started doing proper programming.
I see.
And that was all Java and...
Yeah, that's what I started with too.
Yeah, it wasn't really the best sort of way to get it. When I was at uni, I always thought it was really rubbish.
Really?
Really rubbish at programming. And then I got a job.
And then we became really good.
Oh, I'm all right. I can do this.
Yeah.
So
let's talk about languages, because you mentioned... Because I followed you on Twitter from a long time ago, and I was like, Ruby Jen, it's about... You are all about Ruby, but that's not what you really do.
No, everyone always laughs. I was telling you the story before. I got into Ruby around the time that Twitter was coming out. I think it had been a year or two old. the place I was working, we started doing a bit. Somebody just mentioned it to me about doing some scripting, so automating some of the processes we were doing.
Sure.
Because I'm really, really into like project automation. Mm-hmm. Started playing around with it. I was like, oh, there's a bit of a community. Oh, they're all talking about gems, and because I'm gem,
yeah,
it feels like everyone's talking about me. And decided that I would use that as my Twitter name. Not really doing much, you know, with Ruby. It's not really my main programming language. It is my go-to language now. I do like going and being able to throw stuff together quickly with Snarcher. I've done no Rails.
Yeah.
Zero Rails.
I started doing something in Rails because it was all the rage for a little bit.
Well, when you're used to like MVC in .NET, then it's quite lightweight, I suppose.
Yeah. And so you're primarily a .NET developer, is that true?
I have been, yeah. Most of my career's been in .NET. It's a bit of Java thrown in here and there. The current place where I'm working, uh-huh, I've had some JavaScript as well, done some Ruby in recent times, so doing some Snarcher apps, mm-hmm, JavaScript, Java. We've got Python at the place I'm at the moment.
It feels like once you're like a programmer for a while, you've kind of done a lot of different things, right? Is that the same for you?
Yeah, so there was an interesting talk I went to this morning, which was the C# to F#. Mm-hmm. And the biggest takeaway from that talk, I think it's Scott, the guy who was talking, the biggest takeaway is trying different languages and doing this different paradigm. So if you're going to try and learn a new language, there should be a reason. You should be learning something new.
Right.
So going from like Java to C# or vice versa.
Sure.
Very
not
similar.
Not the same. They're kind of the same.
Same stuff, different syntax. But it's the same approach kind of thing. Whereas if you go to a scripting language like Ruby or Python, that's a different way of doing things. If you start to look at like functional programming, gain another revelation.
I've
and then
always
JavaScript.
Been a fan, yeah.
And I can't really do the asynchronous stuff. It really,
it hurts my head. Yeah, state machines.
It just helps you when you're creating anything. If you've tried a few different ones, and like you say, once you get a bit older and you've tried things, it's not really about doing a deep dive in the language anymore. It's about getting that broad
done,
software craftsmanship. Yeah. That's the word, isn't it?
I've always learned that you should learn an imperative language, a functional language, and a dynamic language. And if you've done those three, you're starting to get a sense for what programming is all about.
I don't think I'll ever get a sense of what programming is all about.
Truth. Hashtag truth. So tell us about your talk. You're speaking here about visualization, mm-hmm, and I started to have a conversation about it before, and I was thinking data visualization. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're talking about?
So I put a tweet out before because this is something that keeps coming up. When you say visualization, what do people think of? And some people think about charts, data stuff. Do you remember years and years and years ago when you had like Real Player and you had all those and you click the visualization?
Yeah, that's right.
And it'd have like the
you like this really cool skin and stuff. Like
my favourite one was Annabelle the Sheep. Did you ever see her?
I did not.
I found a video in the archives.
That's
and
cool.
It was this the sheep that's like rocking out. And then if it gets really heavy, it'll even put a little like top hat on and like a disco ball will come out. It's really cool. But some people think of that as visualizations. Some other people think about it as like modeling your process. Just displaying anything. It's just, my talk's kind of, it's about my journey on how I visualize something. So, because you guys aren't going to be filming my talk, which is very rude.
I'm very sad.
Very rude.
They did not put it in room 5. We're very upset, yeah.
I think we should
Think that NDC will film it and put it up, though.
Oh, okay. I can tell you about it if it's all right.
Well, I want to hear about it.
So I've done this talk. I've done a workshop for quite a few years, and people thought it was really cool that quite a few years ago, I worked at an internal startup, and I found this new way of visualizing user stories, which has turned them into comics.
Right.
So I've done a blog post about it, and everyone thought it was awesome.
That is awesome. Holy cow. That is amazing.
Yeah. So that was my little... So talk about my journey of how I got to that point. I also talk about the evolution of going from... So that's what my workshop's about, like going from normal user stories, which are those horrible gherkin, Azza, I1, given, when, then things, going to actually telling proper stories that have got characters that you can really relate to, and then turn them into comics.
Dang, that's a really good... How come I didn't hear about... How come you didn't call me?
I've got a blog post about it. Why aren't you reading my blog?
Gosh. Why aren't we reading her blog, people? Gosh.
RubyGem.me.
Yeah, that's right. RubyGem. And so you changed those goofy, like, cards into an actual comic strip of people doing something.
Yeah, I was using bit strips, and it was great, but then they got rid of that. But now it's all about the Bitmoji, so I'm not that... Are you on Bitmoji train?
I have not done
Get
it.
On the Bitmoji train,
what
man.
What is that?
I'll show you later on my phone.
Okay.
Yeah, it was.
Is it Bitmoji? What is Bitmoji? Do you know what Bitmoji is?
On the Bitmoji train, people.
You know what it is? You haven't.
It's like
a cartoon version of me.
Yeah, and it's got like little emojis and things, and you can got like face palm.
Why isn't my producer talking to me about like important stuff?
Get on the Bitmoji train.
She doesn't care. She doesn't want me to be here. We should put you on. You should have talked to this woman about this stuff. So Bitmoji. Oh, it's like makes a cartoon out of you.
Yeah.
Okay, I have seen it, but I didn't know you could go do it.
Yeah.
Who draws it for
you? No, they generate it. You kind of pick it, make your own little avatar kind of thing, and it's really cool. Try it later.
Okay.
But they originally did bit strips, and they've taken that away. Now you can get Bitmoji. Mm-hmm. But there's other ways you can do like online generated comics. I think you can get a Marvel one. Imagine having Iron Man as your user stories.
That would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Because you're literally making your users into heroes, which they should be with your software.
Exactly.
You could be like Thor's hammer. That's our software.
I went to Agile Manchester not too long ago, and there's a lady doing a talk about user stories, and she was referencing my talk, which I was like, this is really nice. But what she took away from it was the fact that at the end pain of every single one of my comics, it's the person at the end going, yeah. She's like, it's about those yay moments. So imagine, like you say, Iron Man.
Yeah, I could be Iron Man in a Bitmoji. Yeah. So... So when you talk about visualization, you mean literally anything you see related to software?
Anything. So I get... I got something in my eye.
That's okay. I usually make people tear up. It's my breath, usually.
Too much Parmesan
in that
pasta.
That didn't even make her laugh. Usually I can make her laugh, but it didn't even... Okay. She woke up. Gosh. Camera two, right now, right? Camera... Okay, here we go. So... Tell us a little bit about
it. So that's the kind of first bit of the visualization. Then I went to work at another firm. I went contracting after I'd left the startup, and they were in a bit of trouble. Uh-huh. Everybody thought that the software development team were going to like hit this deadline and deliver this
Ooh,
new idea.
That's scary.
No, it wasn't too bad. They started in January. They had until October to build something.
Oh, there's
some time. It wasn't completely out of the blue and out of the picture. But they were really, really struggling. But nobody knew, because all they had to visualize it was these really complex Jira boards, and nobody could really understand what was going on, including the developers. So I just visualized it in this is a user journey. Here's some screenshots of the user journey that the design team had already made, because you know,
sure,
waterfall, and we ticked off what you could do in the process, and they've been working on it for 3 months. All they've managed to get to is the login screen. So that's when the rest of the business, as I put them up on the walls, realized there was a bit of a problem.
Yeah,
we started to dig a bit deeper, and we jointly between us drew the architecture on a wall with the whole development team sat around. And as we drew it, and as it started to develop, we all sort of stood back, our mouths agog.
Yeah.
The gas, it was a mess. It was no wonder we couldn't get anything done, because the architecture was such a mess. So it was only us, as a group, being able to get things out of our head and visualize that we were able to see that.
I see. So when you talk about visualizing, you're literally talking about get things out of your head.
You see things in your head, or you've got stuff in your head. Get it out. Share.
And the best way to do it is in a way that's easily consumable by everyone. And in the case you're talking about Bitmoji or Bitstrip, we should do a startup. I could be your janitor, where we do like Bitmoji, Bitstrips as a service.
Yeah. Apart from it's gone now. Bitstrips is gone now.
Oh, is it? We can't make another one called like Fitstrips or something?
Yeah, we could do that.
We could do that. We're good looking people. We would be the biggest, best cartoons on Pinterest.
So
once you get stuff out of visualized, what kind of stuff do you discover right away? Because you mentioned that when you drew the architecture, you're like, oh, no wonder nobody's getting anything done. What are some of the kinds of things you've discovered as you visualize things that are surprising?
So this is another bit of the talk where you start to, I then start to morph it in, because I went and joined Co-op Digital, where I work now, and sort of started seeing all these ways that people have visualized things that I'd never seen before, in terms of like the process, like the work process, other things. So I'd done it as like work you completed with these pictures, but also you've got like your swim boards, Kanban boards, all that kind of jazz. And what's been really interesting is looking at like how people do the scrum boards, and it just seems to be like an evolution. So it's the same going back to those user stories where they've gone from like a card and I've evolved them. Mm-hmm. Other people are evolving things. And as you visualise stuff and as you start to refine and distill it, so the story, that comic strip, as time went on, as I started to understand, I refined and distilled and refactored that story over and over until it got to one at the end that I could completely relate to and people who are developers could completely relate to. And as you do the same thing as you draw it and you start to refactor. So getting it down on paper means you can start to find the problems, improve it, you can start to explain it to other people, and if you get more people involved and talking about it, you can help get the idea down a bit. And all of a sudden, so say look at waterfall, you model waterfall process to Scrum. Only by modelling your process can you start to find the problems, which is where you kind of then get into Kanban, which has got you just three, you know, to do in progress, done. And then you can start to go into single piece flow and extreme programming practices as you get rid of some of the process, some of the things that are in there. Another bit I talk about is no backlog and no bugs.
What does that mean?
So which one?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. No backlog means that you don't, like,
have you ever visualized your entire backlog?
No.
Why is that?
Because I write demoware. I'm an evangelist, right?
Yeah.
And so I've written demoware for 10 years. But when I did write software, my backlog was, here's the things that we need to get done that are not in current flight. But there was a list of, this table is, it's supposed to make it more exciting for the viewer, like, are we going to spill the drink or not? I think that's...
So, it nearly went.
Yeah. So
fear, like, in my face.
We had a list of things that we need to get done that were user stories, but we never visualized them.
Why?
I don't know. And the next question I was going to ask you was, someone might say, well, why do I want to spend time drawing all these things for this? What is the benefit? And so help me with that.
So where were you putting all this backlog?
It was like in TFS back then.
Okay, so somebody's taken the time to type them all out.
Yeah.
Okay, and how many were in there, do you think?
For that software I was writing, at any given time, there was probably more than 20 or 30, which is really
20
bad.
Or 30, yeah. Okay, so it's not that bad. When I've spoken at other, when I've done this talk a couple of times last week, I was asking people, they have no idea, there might be 400, 500, and the reason they've not visualised it anyway is because there's too many.
Yeah.
And the problem, I've been at companies before where the backlog has made it so that it's six months from an idea coming up to it going out to live because it's got to go through that backlog.
Yeah, that's not ideal.
No.
Yeah,
and
I see what you're
saying. Ideas
go
off, they're like yogurt. Not like that nice yogurt you had for breakfast this morning.
Yeah,
like,
but if we left it out long enough, it might not be nice.
Yeah,
right?
If they, for example, if they put all, you know, they knew that they had so many guests this week and they put the yogurt pots out for everybody and, like, left them all the yogurt pots in the fridge rather than getting fresh ones each day because you don't know.
Yeah.
It's a really bad analogy, but yeah.
No, it is a good analogy. You can't, you're saying that ideas, their freshness, they have a shelf life. You know, they have a best buy. And you're saying that if you have 400 things in your backlog, those ideas might not be good in 6 months when you're going to get to it. So how do you manage to get an empty backlog then? How do you do that?
So one of the things that I did at this startup I was working at is, because it was a brand new thing, everybody who was involved in this company, and this was like a rescued company, everyone who had ideas, like the CEO, the investors, the salespeople, the engineers. And I sat there and listened to everybody's ideas and I wrote them all down onto post-it notes because agile.
Yeah, of course.
You know?
If you don't have post-it notes, it's not real agile.
And what I found is when you write people's ideas down, it's your problem now. They'll let go. And This reminded me, when in the 90s, I used to go to these like hippie shops, and they had these Guatemala, worry dolls. Mm-hmm. Did you ever see these?
Mm-mm.
These little dolls, and what you do is you have them in a little bag, they're like kind of matchsticks that they dress up, and you tell each of these dolls a worry. Put them in the bag, put them under your pillow, and when you wake up, all your worries have gone.
I need to get me some of those.
Yeah, it's a worry dolls problem now. Yeah. So that I was like, well, worry dolls, so I was writing all their things down. And without them knowing, I threw all their ideas away. If people aren't visualising the backlog, how will anyone know? What happens is the most important ideas come back. If it really matters, it will keep coming back. And once you get the trust, you know, the rest of the team started to realise that. So it got to the point where I had like the CTO and like the, you know, the senior engineers going up to the board and going, because we had like three things in the sort of to do. Go, oh, that's been on there for a couple of weeks.
Take it off.
Throw it in the bin. And it means you can work on the most important thing right now.
I see what you're saying. You're saying that even with my 30 things in the backlog, if they were that important, I would literally be working on it right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're saying that instead of focusing on all the things we could do, you should focus on the things we should do.
Right now.
Those things need to be visualized. And if they're that important, you should be doing it right now.
Yep. Get it out, delivering value as soon as possible. Get rid of all that, you know, that mess that's slowing you down.
Man.
There was a company I was working at, and they had a deal with Lonely Planet,
uh-huh.
the Lonely Planet guides, and they had the deal with them for a whole year.
Uh-huh.
We couldn't get it through the software development process to integrate this onto the website within that year that they had the contract. So it was a waste of money.
I see. And so if it was that important, you would have been able to, but you couldn't.
No, because of the backlog. So the other one I was talking about was no bugs.
Uh-huh. That's the second one, yeah.
Yeah. So what do you think that means? Do you mean, did I have bug-free software?
I don't know. I don't think they're ever, like, let's just say you have a list of 10 bugs and you get them all working and you're like, okay, I fixed those bugs. I think there's never a case that there's not a bug in software. There's always bugs in software, mm-hmm. whether you know them or not. So do you mean like no bugs in your list or no bugs in your software? I don't think you could ever have the latter, but you definitely can have the former, right?
Exactly. So as soon as a bug comes up, mm-hmm. that takes priority over everything. And you will not have a, like, people have bug trackers. You just wouldn't have a bug tracker. It's exactly the same thing as the backlog, because the bugs are never going to take priority. So if you make sure that every single bug has priority, as soon as something's found, could be a bug, could be a feature, it could be a, you know, you've implemented a feature in completely the wrong way or something, and if that takes precedent, that takes priority over new work, you won't have that list of bugs, so you will be, you know, no bugs.
How do you, like, I'm trying to think how that is done, like in practice, have you,
yeah.
What does this look like in practice? Because I know if I get a bug, let's just say I have a way for people to submit bugs. I'm going to get like a couple hundred of them a week or say.
Yeah.
What does that, do I not keep a list? How do I do this Zen-like way of doing it?
It's the same thing with the backlog, the important ones. What is the most important one for you to do now? And the important bugs will keep coming back, because all those ones that reported, a lot of bugs that users will report possibly aren't bugs.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you've got lots of people reporting the same, you should be dropping everything and working on it and getting rid of them.
So you have this triage process as it comes in that you're
well,
like...
This was Greenfield, so it was a bit easier
okay.
than having existing software that's
sure.
got loads of people. But again, it's people getting into the practice of having bug trackers and keeping that list and holding on to it.
Mm-hmm.
And as the code changes, have you got rid of that bug? Is that bug still there? As time goes on, that's worse than yogurt.
Yeah, because, I mean, you might have a bug that's in your backlog, or I don't know if it's called backlog or whatever you have it in, but that bug might even be relevant when you change your system in 2 months.
A feature that you came up with 6 months ago, is that going to be relevant to you today? A bug that someone raised 6 months ago, is that still going to be there? Have you got confidence? You can't know.
So how do you... I'm trying to still visualize how this is done in practice.
Do you know what we need? We need a whiteboard so you can visualize
it. I know, right? So, like, a bug comes in, that's what you look at first? You stop everything you're doing?
Yeah.
Like, as a pro... Like, I'm like a prototype...
No, you need a process that allows you to be able to stop whatever you're doing, though. So you need a really slick release process.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to make sure that your feedback loop is as tight and small as possible.
Okay.
So trying to release software, if it takes you a week to release your software,
yeah.
then people batch things up, don't they?
Yeah.
Which causes problems and bugs because you're adding more changes, you're changing more variables.
Sure.
Whereas if you can get it down so that it's so quick that it's literally like seconds or minutes to go to live, and you've got that confidence that you can put stuff down to live, so you need tests, you need an automated release process, it means that you release little and often. So every line of code that you change, you can make sure that you do that, it's got tests or whatever, goes straight out to live. And it means that if any given point something changes, something happens, you can be agile.
Yeah.
So you can move fast and change direction really quickly. And a lot of the time it's the processes that are slowing people down and allowing us to batch things up.
So what I'm learning here, and this is information I haven't had before, is we need to see what we're trying to do through visualizations, mm-hmm. good user stories. And correct me if I'm wrong. The second thing is you need to live in the now. What's important to make now, what's mm-hmm. important to fix now. And the third is, in order to be able to be in the now, you need to have a process DevOpsed well enough that you can literally be in the now as soon as you want to. Am I getting it right?
Yeah, and again, by visualizing your process and seeing where the bottlenecks are and getting rid of them, you can help to improve the flow, and you can get to single piece flow.
This is some Zen-like stuff, people. I mean, I've never heard it put this way, and it's made me question a lot of the stuff that I've done. There's a lot of work that we do to do work. And it feels like if I'm not doing that work to do work, I could do more work.
And so that's you could deliver value to the customer.
Yeah, and that's what's more important. Yeah, because they pay the bills.
So
where can people go to find out more about you in these talks? I mean, this is good stuff.
So you can go to my blog, follow me on Twitter. So my blog is rubygem.me. I'm ruby_gem on Twitter. There's loads of stuff that's coming out about this on our co-op digital blog as well. Mm-hmm. I think it's digitalblog.coop.co.uk.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got some really impressive people that I work with that know this even better than me. Mm-hmm. And you can also go and check out the Agile Principles, which has got a lot of this on it already.
The Agile Principles, is that where... Is
the Agile Manifesto.
Okay.
You just Google Agile Manifesto, it's on there.
I remember
that. These are
that
all extreme
thing.
Programming practices.
A bunch of people met up in Park City and then wrote this thing out.
Yeah, and
right.
There's a beautiful website that's so 90s it hurts.
Well, it's been a privilege to speak with you, my
it's
friend.
Been lovely.
Thanks so much for being with us. Thanks so much for watching. We're going to have a session coming up about a minute or so. We want to make sure we get you that. And we have tons of good interviews all the way through 7 p.m. tonight here Oslo time. We'll see you in a little bit.